Welcome back, everybody, for another deep dive. This time, we're going to be taking a look at a topic that's honestly pretty intense, the economic policies that completely reshaped India when it was under British rule, you know, that period between 1757 and 1947. And, you know, our listeners sent in some pretty interesting sources for this one. We've got excerpts from economic histories, architectural studies. Heck, we even have some linguistic analysis in here.
Yeah, it's a fascinating mix.
It might not sound super exciting at first glance, but I think you're going to be surprised by some of the stuff we find in these texts.
Yeah, what I find so interesting about this collection of sources is how they show us how closely economics and power were connected during this time. Yeah. And we're not just talking about some abstract theories here. We're going to see how these policies actually played out in the lives of millions of people.
It's crazy to think about how the East India Company, this huge force that ended up ruling India, started out as, well, a bunch of traders. And according to one of our sources, they had no clue how India actually worked.
Yeah, that's true. Their early focus was almost entirely on making money, with very little understanding of the complex, you know, social and economic systems that were already in place. One historian even mentions that a lot of the company agents barely ever left the coastal areas, and a lot of them didn't even speak any Indian languages.
So how did they go from these clueless traders to, you know, rulers of an empire? It seems like a pretty big jump.
Well, it was a gradual process, for sure. A lot of missteps along the way, and eventually a more intentional power grab. The big turning point came with a series of acts passed by the British Parliament, starting in the 1770s.
Okay.
The goal of these acts was to regulate the East India Company, and eventually they led to the creation of something called the Board of Control in 1783. Now, this was a huge shift because it marked the British government's attempt to take more control over the company and what they were doing in India.
So this is where we start hearing about the whole trusteeship idea, right?
Yeah.
The British trying to make it seem like they were acting in India's best interest.
Exactly. It became a really important part of their whole justification for being there. But here's the thing. The reality on the ground often didn't match up with what they were saying. Take the Cornwallis settlement of 1793, for example. It completely changed the land revenue system, which was like the backbone of the Indian economy. But get this. It was based on a fundamental misunderstanding of how that system worked.
Okay, so break this down for me. What was so different about the British approach to this?
Well, the British, they saw the existing system as, well, confusing, inefficient.
Okay.
They wanted to impose a sense of order, you know, a very Western concept of order, on a system that had been evolving organically for centuries. And the result was, well, anything but orderly.
So who ended up paying the price for this order?
The Indian peasantry, primarily. The Cornwallis settlement basically took these zamindars, who were traditionally revenue collectors with very limited ownership rights, and turned them into landlords with the power to kick tenants off their land.
Wow, so the British basically created a whole new class of landowners who were loyal to them.
In a sense, yeah. And these new landlords had to pay a fixed revenue demand to the British. Often, these demands were way too high. And if they couldn't pay, well, they risked losing their estates. This put a ton of pressure on them to get as much as they could from the land and the people who worked it.
Sounds like the British were trying to have their cake and eat it too. They wanted the money, but they didn't want to actually deal with managing the land or the people.
That's a great point. And it's important to understand that this whole push for revenue was driven by some of the popular economic theories of the time. Like, think of Ricardo, for example. He was arguing that the state had the right to extract as much revenue as possible from the land. He called it the unearned increment.
So basically, they were using fancy economic theories to, you know, justify exploiting India.
Well, that's one way to put it. And the Cornwallis settlement, that was just one piece of a much bigger puzzle. The British, they created a whole system of policies designed to take resources from India and send them back to Britain.
Can you give me some specific examples? What kinds of resources were they after?
Well, think about the Industrial Revolution that was happening in Britain at the time. They needed a lot of raw materials, and India became a major supplier, like cotton, for example. Mm. The demand for Indian cotton just exploded, fueled by all those new textile mills popping up in Britain. So this led to a huge shift in Indian agriculture. Farmers were often forced to abandon what they had traditionally grown and focus on cotton instead.
So it wasn't just the British buying what India was already producing. They were actually forcing India to change its economy to suit their needs.
Exactly. And cotton's just one example. Indigo, that was another important one, prized for its deep blue dye. And the British, they pushed for more and more indigo production, often under incredibly harsh conditions for the Indian farmers and workers.
So we're seeing the pattern here. The British needed something, so they forced India's economy to provide it. And they didn't seem to care much about the consequences for the Indian people.
You're picking up on that, and it's a really important point. And to make matters even worse, they didn't just extract resources, they also imposed a whole system of heavy taxes that put even more pressure on the people.
What kind of taxes are we talking about?
Taxes on everything you can imagine. Salt, land, even opium. These taxes brought in a lot of money for the British, but they were a huge burden on the Indian economy.
This is all pretty overwhelming, to be honest. We've got land revenue, resource extraction, oppressive taxation. It feels like we've barely scratched the surface here.
Yeah, there's definitely a lot more to cover. We haven't even talked about the impact on local economies, the decline of traditional industries, or the rise of new ones that really only benefited the British. And all of this had a huge impact, not just on the economy of India, but on its culture and architecture as well.
Well, it seems like we have a lot more to explore in this deep dive. So stick with us, listeners. We'll be back after a quick...
Oh, hold on a second. Before we move on, I think it's important to stop and consider what we've learned so far. You know, the British, they didn't just accidentally end up ruling India. They very deliberately changed the country's whole economic system to benefit themselves.
That's a really good point. It was a very intentional process of exploitation.
Yeah.
And they used economic theories to justify it, while hiding behind that whole trusteeship idea.
And we can't forget, we're not just talking about numbers and statistics here. We're talking about the lives of millions of people who were deeply affected by these policies. It's amazing when you think about how much the British really transformed India's economy. Some industries were totally wiped out, while others, you know, they seem to have done well. But even that success, you got to look at it carefully.
Yeah, it's like there were winners and losers, but the stakes were incredibly high. So let's start with the losers, I guess. Which industries were hit the hardest by these policies?
Oh, one of the saddest examples is India's traditional textile industry. You know, for centuries, India was known for its amazing textiles, but then all this cheap cloth started coming in from British factories made by machines. It just devastated the industry.
Classic undercutting. Flood the market with cheaper goods, and suddenly your competition's gone.
Exactly. And the British, they didn't just sit back and let market forces do their thing. They actually made policies to discourage Indian textile production, like heavy taxes on Indian-made cloth. Imagine the impact on all those weavers and artisans who lost their jobs, their skills suddenly worthless.
It's hard to even imagine the human cost of all of this. It's easy to get caught up in the economics of it all, but real people's lives were being destroyed.
You're right. It's a tragedy. And we see this same pattern in other industries, too. Shipbuilding, for instance, was another sector that suffered. India had a thriving shipbuilding industry, but once again, British policies favored British shipyards, and that led to the decline of a once flourishing industry.
So it's not like the British were just content with taking what India already had. They also wanted to make sure India couldn't compete with them.
Yeah, exactly. If they wanted to stay on top, they had to stop India from developing its own industrial base.
But I'm guessing there were some industries that actually benefited from British rule, right?
There were. Tea, for example. The tea industry grew quite a bit under the British, but we have to analyze this growth very carefully. Think about it. Huge areas of land were turned into tea plantations. Often this meant pushing local people off their land. And the labor practices on these plantations, they were often exploitative. The profits, well, they mainly went back to Britain, enriching British companies and investors.
So basically, the success of the tea industry came at a high price for a lot of Indians.
That's right. It's a perfect example of how something that looks beneficial on the surface can actually hide a darker truth, a reality of exploitation. And the impact wasn't just about material wealth, it had cultural implications too.
Oh, how so? What kind of cultural impact did these policies have?
Well, think about architecture, for instance. The British didn't just change the physical landscape by building new structures. They brought in new architectural styles, new techniques that reflected their own cultural values. You know, these new buildings often became symbols of British power. It was a deliberate attempt to reshape the visual landscape of India.
Almost like they were trying to get rid of the existing cultural identity and replace it with their own.
I think there's some truth to that, but we also have to remember that Indian culture is incredibly resilient. Some things are definitely suppressed, but others adapted and evolved. We see this amazing blend of influences. Take the Victoria Terminus in Mumbai, for example. It's this mix of Gothic revival architecture and traditional Indian elements. It's a really visual reminder of the complex cultural interactions that were happening at that time.
It shows that these colonial encounters weren't just a one-way street. It wasn't just about one culture dominating another. There was push and pull, dominance and resistance.
Yeah, absolutely.
Speaking of resistance, how did Indians actually respond to all of this exploitation? They didn't just sit back and take it, did they?
No, absolutely not. They resisted in so many ways. From small acts of defiance to these large-scale movements, peasant uprisings were common. Often they targeted symbols of British authority, like the tax collectors or indigo planters.
Yeah, they found ways to fight back, even though they didn't have the same kind of military power as the British.
Yes, exactly. And these weren't just, you know, random outbursts of anger. A lot of them were very well organized. They used existing social networks and drew on traditions of resistance. And even though they didn't always win outright, they wore down British power. They forced the British to make concessions, and they showed just how much discontent was growing.
So these acts of resistance, even the small ones, they were really important in that bigger fight against colonial rule.
Absolutely. And then on top of those localized uprisings, we see the emergence of this broader movement for economic and political autonomy.
Is there anyone in particular who embodies this struggle?
Well, I think Mahatma Gandhi is a great example. He understood that this economic exploitation was at the heart of British rule, and he pushed for a strategy of nonviolent resistance aimed at achieving both political and economic independence.
So for Gandhi, true freedom wasn't just about getting rid of British political control. It was also about having control over their own economy.
Precisely. He believed that India needed to control its own resources and be in charge of its own economic future. And his strategy of nonviolent resistance, using things like boycotts of British goods, was a really clever way to hit the British where it hurt their wallets.
It's interesting how these ideas of economic resistance and self-sufficiency became part of the larger movement for Indian independence.
Yeah, it shows us that the struggle against colonialism was about so much more than just political slogans and battles. It was about reclaiming control, control over resources, over livelihoods, ultimately over their own economic future. But with all this resistance, did the British ever actually admit to what they had done?
Yeah, did they ever actually try to fix things?
Well, it's complicated. They did make some reforms, but usually only when they were under a lot of pressure from Indian nationalists. The basic structure of British economic control, that didn't really change. They were good at adapting, you know, making the system seem less obviously exploitative, but they never really gave up their control over India's economy.
So when India finally got its independence in 1947, what kind of economic situation did it inherit?
A very difficult one, marked by the scars of exploitation, scars that are still visible in India today.
We're back, and wow, this deep dive has really been something else. We've uncovered this whole history of exploitation, and it's both fascinating and really disturbing.
Yeah, it's true. And I think it's important that we don't try to avoid these difficult parts of history. You know, if we want to understand the complexities of the world we live in today, we have to understand this history.
So as we wrap up this exploration, I'm wondering, what are some of the lasting impacts of all this exploitation? How do we see those echoes in India today?
Well, one of the most obvious ones is the persistence of poverty and inequality. I mean, India has come a long way in terms of economic development since independence, but the gap between the rich and the poor, it's still huge. And a lot of the underlying problems, you know, the structural issues, those can be traced back to this colonial period.
So basically, the roots of some of India's current economic challenges were planted during British rule.
Yeah, to a large degree. This systematic extraction of wealth, the destruction of traditional industries, the creation of an economy that was dependent on Britain, all of these things have had a really lasting impact.
It's a good reminder that the past isn't really over. It still shapes the present in some pretty powerful ways.
And it's not just about India either. I think this history has lessons for all of us. You know, it makes us think about how economic power can be used to exploit others, and it makes us question those systems that perpetuate inequality.
So what are some of the big takeaways here, the broader lessons we can learn from all of this?
Well, one crucial lesson is the danger of putting profit before people. We saw the terrible consequences of that in colonial India. And honestly, we still see similar things happening in different parts of the world even today.
It's a reminder that we need to be paying attention to keep challenging those systems that benefit a small group of people at the expense of everyone else.
Right. And another important takeaway is that economic power and political power, they're connected. The British, they used their political control to take over India's economy. They took resources, shaped the economy to serve their own interests.
And we see that happening today, too. Economic power often influences political decisions and shakes global systems in ways that benefit the powerful.
Exactly. And that's why we need more transparency, more accountability in both our economic and political systems. We need to make sure that these systems are working for the benefit of everyone, not just a select few.
This deep dive has also shown how important it is to recognize and value different economic models. You know, the British just imposed their system on India. They didn't really care about the existing systems and traditions that had been working for Indian society for centuries. And ignoring that local knowledge, those traditional practices, well, it often led to unexpected problems, and it made the negative effects of their policies even worse.
Yeah, it's a lesson we can apply even today. There is no single solution for economic development that works everywhere. We have to consider the local context, and we need to support those solutions that come from within communities themselves.
And even with all this talk about exploitation, we can't forget about the power of resistance. Throughout this whole deep dive, we've seen how Indians resisted British rule. In so many ways, small acts of defiance to these big movements for economic and political independence.
Their struggle is a really powerful reminder. Even when you're facing what seems like overwhelming power, resistance is always possible. And collective action, it can bring about real change.
I think this deep dive has really underlined the importance of remembering. It's easy to dismiss the past, to think it doesn't matter anymore. But as we've seen, the impact of colonialism is still felt today.
You're absolutely right. If we want to create a better future, a future that's more just and more equal, we have to understand these legacies.
Well said. It's been a heavy topic, for sure, but an incredibly important one. I hope this deep dive has given our listeners a new way to think about this period in history and how it's still relevant to our lives today.
And as always, we encourage you to keep learning, to keep asking those questions, and to never stop trying to understand those forces that shape the world around us.